Okay, so let us continue with the questions. Today there's lots more, which is a good sign of people getting interested. That's great. Okay, so let us start off. Dear Ajahn Brahmani, when I am meditating, if I change my posture when only a little pain arises, I find it is a bit restless and stillness can hardly be cultivated to a deeper status. I also heard that a certain extent of tolerance on pain can be a practice of Kanti paramita. May you share with us, is there a middle way on the time to change the posture? Thanks again. Thanks for your inspiring and profound teachings every year, and do come back again. We all miss you. Okay, that's very nice. Yes, there is a middle way. You should not change straight away just because you have a little bit of pain. What you should look for is the pain is like persistent and it becomes like obsessive. The mind goes back to the pain all the time. Yeah, you know what I mean? Sometimes the mind, you can't stay off the pain because it's there all the time. If it's just a little bit of pain, and then you can just leave it to one side, you can stay with the breath, it doesn't obsess the mind, then there is no problem there. But when you feel like it is disturbing your meditation, that is really the time to move away. Because pain comes and goes sometimes, and that's fine. But when it becomes a problem, that is when you have to move away from the pain. So quite right, middle way. Everything is middle way, right? It's a very useful little Buddhist idea. Middle way everywhere, and you're on the right track. And Kanti paramita, should you practice the Kanti paramita? Yeah, you can look at it that way. Paramitas is really a much later idea in Buddhism. It came a long time after the Buddha. But you can look at it like that, because Kanti or Kshanti is always good, because patience is such an important part of the path. So it certainly is a useful thing here. Okay. Dear Ajahn, what is your view on assisted suicide when the person is suffering from unbearable pain? So assisted suicide, what you have to do is you have to go back to the basic ideas of Buddhist ethics. And remember what I was saying yesterday, that the Buddhist, in the final analysis, the Buddhist ethics is an ethics of motivation. What is motivating you to do a particular act? And if that motivation is coming from compassion, it's never wrong. Yeah, compassion motivation is never wrong. So if a person who is contemplating to end their life, through assisted suicide, if they are doing it because the pain is unbearable, they're not doing it because of any kind of greed or anger or anything like that. It's just that this doesn't make any sense anymore to carry on like this because the pain is unbearable. It's kind of compassion for yourself almost. And then the person who helps them, who also sees the situation, has compassion for them. If both people have compassion and are coming from a position of being reasonable, then I don't think you can do very much wrong by assisted suicide. It's a very controversial view in Buddhism, because most people would say that it is a bad thing to do, but I don't think it is a major problem if you do that. But you have to be very careful. You have to look at your mind. You have to make sure that you are coming from the right place. You're not kind of coming from any kind of defilements, anything like that. You have clarity, you know what you're doing. You're not depressed or anything like that, because when you're depressed, you're going to make silly mistakes. But I don't think there can be a major problem in that kind of situation. I cannot give you a specific advice. Yes, it is right, it is wrong. And one reason I can't do that is because it is against my precepts to kind of recommend the dying at any time. All I can say is the karmic consequences. I can tell you the Dhamma, which are the karmic consequences. I don't think there will be very bad karmic consequences if you do that. Could it maybe even be good karmic consequences if you're truly coming from compassion? But be careful, because now you're kind of getting into gray areas. You have to be careful. As long as you are careful and reasonable, you should be okay. Very good. Okay. Next one. Venerable, thank you for your insightful Dhamma talks regarding breathing meditation. We have to be aware of the quality of the breath, long, short, deep, shallow, etc. What is the time to make the distinction? after one breathing or breathing out, or after one pair, I in or out. Really what it means is just that you are aware of each individual breath. That's what it means. Yeah. So you know whether the breath is long or short. It means that you are aware of each individual one. That's really all it means. It doesn't matter if it's long or short. It doesn't matter if it's, what was the other words you use? Is it deep or shallow? I think that's Ajahn Sujato's translation on Sutta Central. It doesn't matter. What matters is that you have the awareness. You have enough awareness that if someone went to ask you, you will be able to explain because you have seen the breath. So it's just the ability to be aware. We're going to go through the Anapanasati Sutta tomorrow morning. I'll explain these things in detail. And then you expand your awareness after a while, and then you kind of see more and more of the breath. Your mindfulness is becoming stronger, and your ability to see the entire breath expands as a consequence. So that's really all it is. So each breath, you know, in, out, long, short, whatever. Long, short is just an excuse for knowing the breath. That's really all it is. So you have awareness of the breath. So each one. So not after the pair, but each one as they go along. Okay. Dear Ajahn, is it possible to be mindfully observing, enjoying sensual pleasures without creating attachment? Thank you. No, it is not possible. By its very nature, if you enjoy sensual enjoyment, by its very nature, it is craving attachment is there. It goes without that. It's impossible to have these things without desire, without craving, without attachment. It's all part and parcel, all comes together. Yeah, it is kind of one bundle of things coming together. I think there's even a sutta where the Buddha talks about this to some extent. I think this is the Alagadupama Sutta, Majjhima 22, I think it is, the simile of the snake, where the Buddha talks about sensual pleasures. Specifically, there is a monk called Aritta, I think his name, Aritta, and he argues that sensual pleasure is not a problem. Yeah, there's no issue. And the Buddha tells him off quite severely for saying that, because it is one of the main obstacles on the path. If you're going to go a long, long way on the path, especially if you're going to attain deep samadhi, it is a main obstacle. And the Buddha tells him off, and the Buddha then says that it is impossible to enjoy sensual pleasures without having sensual craving, without having sensual perceptions and all these kind of things. Majjhima 22, if you want to look it up. It's a very nice sutta, actually. It's a large sutta on the non-self, really. But it starts... No, wait a minute. Am I telling the right sutta now? Oh, I'm getting confused now. Maybe I'm giving you the wrong sutta. Whoa. Is that bad karma? I'm not sure. What is it? Does anyone else know? What is it, the sutta where she talks about this sati? I think it is that sutta, but I could be mistaken. You check for me, okay. I've got my assistant over there checking the suttas out for me. Okay, thanks, Gerald. 22, yeah. I know it is Alagadupama Sutta. I'm not sure whether it is concerned that topic. I'm a bit confused now. Anyway, so, okay. Hope that answers your question. If not, please come back again tomorrow. Alagadupama Sutta. Yeah, simile of the snake, yeah. Yeah. I know that is correct. I was wondering whether the content was correct. But anyway, yeah, never mind. Yeah. Is that right? Okay, you're good. So I got some other experts here with me. That's good. Okay, that's what I thought. Okay, great. Okay, let's just move on. Dear Ajahn, I am able to stay with the breath and breathing in and out fully with rapture and light. Okay, that's wonderful. Next, what should I do? Should I practice the same object or change the meditation guidance? Thank you. No, you should please stay with the same object. One of the things that I will point out to you tomorrow is that the mindfulness of breathing takes you all the way to arahantship. Yeah, you can become fully enlightened just by watching the breath. It's a very, very powerful meditation technique. So please stay with the breath. So when the rapture starts to arise, it means that you have come to a certain stage in the Anapanasati. You're already doing really well. So, you know, you should be really pleased that you're doing so well in your meditation. Actually, don't feel proud about it. Just feel pleased that you're doing well. And if you're seeing lights in your meditation, that's also a wonderful thing. So I will place this thing in the Anapanasati Sutta tomorrow so you know roughly where you're at. But you continue developing it. And as you continue developing it, you take this all the way to the jhana states. And then when you get into jhana, then afterwards, that is when you're ready for insight. Yeah, so the thing that you will see is that as you develop this, the breath becomes more and more subtle. But the breath is kind of still there in the background. And I will tell you a bit more about how to deal with this tomorrow. So please keep on doing the same thing. You're already doing so well. So if you change your object, very likely that you will lose out on that development of the breath meditation. And then you will lose that momentum that you have already built up. So please practicing like that. That's really nice. Okay, I have a stiff body and have the difficulty to sitting straight. What is the best strategy to deal with this situation? So you have difficulty sitting straight, okay? You can sit on a chair. Yeah, you can lean back on a chair and be comfortable. And when you lean back on a chair, it's easier to be straight. Or you can, when you go back home, you can have an even more comfortable chair, yeah, where you kind of, like an armchair or something. Then you can use an armchair, as long as you don't fall asleep, it's okay, as long as you have some clarity of the mind. So it's really about finding a good posture for yourself. That's really the critical issue. And it can be any posture where you feel at ease. Yeah, that's the most important thing. One of the allowable postures also is you can lie down. One of the people here were telling me that he's a disciple of Ajahn Gunha. Ajahn Gunha is a very famous monk in Thailand. And he came to Bodhinyana Monastery, actually been to Bodhinyana Monastery many times. At one time he was stayed for almost a year at Bodhinyana Monastery. And one time he came, we asked him how he meditates, and he said he lies down. Then what do you do? Then I do nothing, he said. And then we said, well, if you don't do anything, don't you fall asleep? No, he said, that would be doing something. Right? Like, try to understand that, yeah? If you are completely mindful, not doing anything, sleep is like switching something off, you go to sleep, but he's just completely mindful. So you can't lie down. So try, if you find the stiffness in the body, you have problem relaxing or whatever, lie down and see what happens. But if you lie down, then lie down in a posture that you normally don't sleep in. So like lie down on your back, for example. Most people, they sleep on their side. So lie down on your back and see what happens. Find a surface that is not too soft. Maybe this is kind of nice, yeah, kind of a thin mattress like this. And lie down on that and see what happens. It may not work. Many people get too tired when that happens, but you can try it out, at least sometimes. You find a posture that suits you. You can also do walking meditation. Yeah, don't have to be sitting or whatever. And walking back and forth can be very nice and soothing, and feel very nice as well. Sometimes your meditation will not go as deep when you do walking meditation, but still it can be good as a balance to all the sitting. So just experiment a little bit. Very often the best thing is not to just take advice of the teacher, but actually to try yourself and find the way yourself. Often you gain far more wisdom if you find the way yourself than if you listen to somebody else. Because you actually are looking, you are investigating. And when you do that, you grow in wisdom very fast as a consequence. So, see what happens. Okay, respect to you, Ajahn. Thank you very much for guiding us to real happiness through our teachings of the Buddha. May your all wishes come true. May you be healthy and may you have enough strength to teach the Dhamma for the whole world. Wow. Okay, that sounds like a burden. Are you sure? The whole world is a lot, you know. Anyway, sadhu times three. That's very kind of. I'm not going to say your name because sometimes that's kind of nice to be a bit. I do that with everyone, but never say the name, so it probably makes things a bit easier. But anyway, that's very kind of you to say that. Much appreciated. Okay. Next one. Thank you for all the teachings. I just noticed I have a lot of fear during meditation. Whenever there is any noise or anyone walking past, fear arises, muscle tensing up, not knowing why. I worry here. I might get hurt. Can you share your advice on how to overcome this situation? Okay, well, the best way is to, I guess there are many things, but you know, here you are in this really nice community with people around you. Yeah, this shouldn't be able to, you probably should feel very safe in this kind of community with people like this, because these are good people come together, and you're not going to find probably a place much more safe than this, I would think. So just try to change your perception of the people around you. Remind yourself that these are good people. What's the point of coming on a retreat like this? If you're not good, there's no point. It's kind of mad. If you just come to torture yourself, it doesn't make any sense. You come here to develop positive qualities. Yeah, so think about it like that. And if you have the opportunity to get to know these people a little bit more by maybe going on other retreats with them or going to any arrangements or going to one of the meditation groups or whatever it is, do that. I know that there are some people here who go to regular meditation groups, for example. And as you get to know people, you start to feel more at ease with them. Often with strangers, you may be a little bit uncertain, but after a while you feel more at ease. And you can kind of hang out with that group and feel better. But remember that the problem with fear and anxiety is always thinking that something might go wrong in the future. Yeah, it's some conditioning from the past whereby you always think the future is kind of fearful and dangerous and something might go wrong. But instead of thinking like that, try to recondition your mind to think what might go right in the future. Yeah, usually things go right. Things don't usually go wrong. Usually they go right. Only occasionally do they go wrong. And yet somehow we focus too much on those things that go wrong. So instead try to focus on those things that can go right. Everything usually goes right. So remember that, especially in a place like this. Not only go right, they go better than right sometimes. So remember that. And also when you are on practicing the Buddhist path, usually there is kind of a gradual improvement in things. Yeah, things are getting better and better and better over time. So you're on the highway to positive things in the future. Your general trend in your life is going to be better. Yeah, if you keep on practicing like this, your general trend is going to be better. So you only have good things to look forward to, really. Yeah, so this is why you change your perception, reduce anxiety, have a sense of metta for the people around you. Understand that this is a pretty safe place. I don't know everyone here, but I feel very safe in here, at least. I don't know about you, I feel really safe. Maybe I'm deluded, maybe I shouldn't feel so safe. No. No, I'm just messing around. I'm not sure, this is probably not very helpful for you. So see the goodness in people around you, and then this will help you a lot. But sometimes our fear and anxieties can be very deep-seated, and sometimes it can take a while to overcome these things. Yeah, so you have to sort of keep at it for a while, and eventually you will gradually get out of it. Okay, how frequent should one go on a retreat? It is difficult to go back to the real world after a retreat. Yeah, it's kind of difficult, but you know, that's part of the learning experience. Yeah, this is part of the learning. You go back and then you realize, actually, you know, you've gone on a retreat and it was pretty nice. And that tells you something about the world. It tells you something about happiness. It tells you something about all of these things. So learn from that. Try to understand why it is the case that it is difficult. Yeah. It is difficult precisely because you find something meaningful and purposeful on a retreat that you cannot find in the real world. So how often should you go? Whatever you want to do, it's up to you. It's really completely up to you. I would recommend go at least once a year. But you can of course go more often. Go as much as you like, really. And remember, one of the things to do when you go on retreat, compare a little bit what is happening on this retreat compared to the previous one. Don't compare as you go along, compare after the retreat. And then think, well, what happened? Was this retreat better than the last one? Was my mindfulness better? Did I get more peace in my mind? Did I have more good qualities in my heart? Look at that, because that tells you whether your practice is working. If you find that on one retreat you are better than you were in the previous one, it means your practice is actually working. Your daily routine is working for you. And this is so important, because if it isn't working, if you're not making any progress, then you need to look at your life and ask yourself, what can I do better? This is how we make progress. This is how we resolve issues. This is how we find out what is working and what isn't working. So we have to use our kind of analytical mind a little bit to try to resolve any blockages that might be there, blockages to progress. But do as much as you like. If you really enjoy the retreats, do many. It's good. And please come down to Perth. We have a really nice meditation center in Perth as well, if you haven't been there before. The Dharma Grover Center is also very beautiful, and very good, nice nature and things down there. Lots of kangaroos. Kangaroos are kind of cool. So please come down there as well if you have the opportunity. I'm sure you will enjoy that. And you can hang around the Sangha a little bit. You can come over to Bodhinyana Monastery. We also have a very nice meditation hall at Bodhinyana Monastery. Many people love to go there and to sit in the hall at Bodhinyana Monastery, because it has quite a strong feeling of peace in that hall. It has been used a lot, and for that reason by very good meditators like Ajahn Brahm. So kind of the vibe in the hall, it's kind of meditation, it's kind of gone into the walls, and it kind of radiates back to you, the stillness and the peace. That's what happens there. Okay, let's go on to the next one. In Ajahn Brahm's book Kindfulness, a story about a woman being invited for a cup of coffee by a friend called C.F. C.F. is a control freak, trying to control the woman as to what to drink, where to sit, etc. Ajahn Brahm's advice is to treat your mind like a best friend. My question, who is C.F., i.e. who is the one who deals with the mind? The mind deals with the mind. It is just the same thing. The mind deals with itself. That is what is going on here. There's nothing behind the mind that deals with the mind. It's just the five khandhas overlooking the five khandhas, in a sense. That's really all it is. Mind working on mind. So awareness is just one aspect of the mind, and then you have the various kind of aspects. There's nothing beyond that which looks at these things. That makes sense. That's how it works according to the Buddha's original early Buddhist text teachings. Don't be CF, CF control freak. That is always a problem. And the thing is that if you are control freak with other people, very often you become control freak with yourself as well. You try to control your own mind. You try to be a certain person. Holding on, watching the breath with too much willpower. And all of that doesn't really lead you anywhere. So letting go is always very nice. One of the things that I love about staying at Bodhinyana Monastery is that Ajahn Brahm usually lets go a lot. He allows you to do your own practice, to do your own thing. He doesn't control you at all, and it's really up to you to take responsibility for your own practice. And it's very powerful, because when the motivation comes from inside of you rather than from the control on the outside, you tend to make far more progress in your practice, because it's coming from you rather than the outside. So Bodhinyana Monastery is quite a relaxed place compared to most monasteries, precisely because there is so little control going on down there, which is really nice. Let's let letting go, letting people be, letting them take responsibility. But you have to be quite mature. If you're just a young kid or whatever, it can be difficult to deal with that kind of environment. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, one, can you elaborate on the concept of non-self? If there is no I or self, then what is reborn in the rebirth? Okay, so what is reborn in the rebirth is the mind, basically. Yeah, the mind carries on from one life to another one. So the way to think about this is to think about your life right here and right now. Yeah, and you think about your mind now, today, compared to, say, your mind 10 years ago. That mind that you had 10 years ago compared to the mind you have now, is it the same or is it different? Both, right? It's both the same, there's similarities, and it's also different. There is change and continuity. You cannot say that there is anything permanent that actually lasts through that. If you look at your mind very carefully, you will see it's always changing phenomena going through right here in this life. There is continuity because there are certain habits that you carry with you from one moment to the next one, from one year to another one. So there is continuity, but there's also change all the time in that mind. And it's exactly the same thing that happens when you go from one life to the next one. Yeah, there is continuity and there is change. And for this reason, when you, if you ever recall your past lives, you will know it is you in that past life. Why? Because of the continuity. But at the same time, if you look carefully, there's also no permanent essence to that thing. It's like changing all the time. Yeah. So there's no essence to it. So the mind that goes across lifetimes is exactly the same as the mind that you have in this life now. So if there's no self now in this life, there's also no self going from one life to the next one. A nice way of thinking about this is to think about a river. When you see a river flowing by, yeah, 1 second to the next one, there's nothing, the water is not the same. The water molecules have completely changed from every moment to moment. The water molecules are completely different. It's not the same water that you find in that river from one moment to the next one. But if you look at the shape of the river tends to be the same from one moment to the next one. Maybe over a long period of time, the shape of the river will change. Why? Because maybe there's a lot of rainfalls, the river swells up, becomes larger. Or you have a drought, so the water in the river goes down. So over long periods of time, there is changes in shape. But the general shape of the river tends to be the same moment to moment. But the actual water is different moment to moment to moment. It's the same thing with the thing we call a person. The shape of who you are tends to be stable over time. There is a certain degree of continuity there, yeah? Over long periods of time, you may change quite a bit. Once you become a Buddhist and you practice well, you become more... Things change, yeah, because you are practicing in the right way. But your actual mind, if you look very carefully at the elements of the mind, they're changing all the time, very fast and very rapidly. That's how it works. And this is the Buddha's insight. And it's very hard to grasp. It's actually very profound. And it's very difficult to grasp because our outlook, our way of looking at things, is so incredibly habitually ingrained that we see a self there at all times. That this is like a revolution in our outlook on the world when you see non-self. It is the most profound insight you can have. And it's the one insight that distinguishes the Buddhist teachings and the way the Buddha taught from all other teachings. This is the one thing that makes Buddhism, Buddhism, the non-self idea. Question number two. Does the concept of interconnectedness, the idea that ultimately we are all connected, dependent on one another, and every act affects all other people and vice versa, exist in the suttas? It doesn't exist quite in the way that it is used in the modern world, yeah, in the modern world, we kind of talk about interconnectedness and we're all connected. We are all connected to some extent, but we are also all separated to some extent. Yeah, it is possible to make yourself less affected by other people around you. If your mind becomes very strong and very powerful, you will be very solid in yourself and you won't be affected by people around you so much. On the other hand, people who have a very undeveloped mind will be very affected by people around them. For example, in samadhi, you are completely, in one sense, you are completely disconnected because you are withdrawn inside of yourself. On the other hand, if you look inside your heart, you actually feel connected with the whole world as if you have touched a larger reality. So it is not really found in the suttas in that sense. Usually, it is when people talk about interconnectedness, usually they refer back to dependent origination. That's usually what they refer back to. But dependent origination is not really about interconnectedness. Dependent origination is to show you how suffering arises, what are the causes of suffering, and how suffering arises through rebirth. Rebirth is an important part of dependent origination, and how it happens without a self, without a permanent essence there. And the root cause of suffering is avidya. It is delusion, or it's often translated as ignorance, but ignorance, not a very good translation. Delusion is much better. The root cause of suffering is delusion. That's why we suffer. So by giving rise to understanding and insight, that's how you overcome suffering. But dependent origination doesn't really talk about interconnectedness in that way. It's a different kind of concept, different kind of idea. So sometimes I think we can exaggerate the interconnectedness. Sure, of course we are interconnected, it's obvious, yes? When I sit here and talk, you hear what I say, so there must be some connection, otherwise you wouldn't be able to hear me. And lots of connection like that, of course, in the world today. Lots of connections, but also, there is also a degree of disconnection as well. So there needs to be a balance in these kind of concepts. But it's useful sometimes to think about interconnectedness because sometimes it makes us more aware of how we affect other people around us. Yeah, if everyone is responsible for things like climate change, for example, that's an obvious example of interconnectedness. Yeah, the whole world. If one person pollutes, it affects everyone else. Yeah, that's a really powerful example of interconnectedness. So each one of us is kind of responsible for 7 billion people. So anyway, don't take that too seriously, otherwise you might get depressed, but you know what I mean. We all have, the alternative, of course, is that if we do care for the environment or whatever, we're actually supporting everyone in the world, which is a very nice way of thinking about it. Okay, next question. Dear Ajahn, how do we practice contemplation of the four elements in accordance to the Satipatthana Sutta? What will be the object of meditation for the four elements? Do we seek it out or wait for it to arise? Thank you, Sadhu times three. Four element meditation, there is different ways that these meditations can be done. But these are mostly what I would consider contemplation meditations. So you reflect on the body here. You reflect that the body is just like the elements outside. So you think about it, you think, earth element. And you dwell on that, You dwell on that idea until it becomes very strong. And you start to really feel that your body actually is like the earth outside. There isn't really any distinction between the two. So you reflect on that again and again and again until it starts to sink in. This is really what this is about. You can also use these kind of, the body, the earth, you can use it as a samadhi object as well, but then it's really different, then it uses some of its power of reflection. The idea here is really to abandon attachment to the body. If you use it to attain samadhi, then you're using it slightly differently. Same thing with the 31 parts of the body. You can use it to look at, for example, the skeleton. So you see yourself as a skeleton. Okay, skeleton is right here. It's kind of nice, isn't it? The skeleton. This skeleton is with me. All that we tend to be afraid of skeletons, but here it is, right here. Skeleton. The hard bone. Yeah, the skeleton right there. It's right here. So you kind of see yourself as a skeleton. And of course, straight away, when you see yourself as a skeleton, it takes away the beauty of the body. Yeah? A skeleton is kind of neutral. So the skeleton is here. It's right here. Skeleton, everywhere. You can see the bones. Yeah, you see the whole thing, the ribs, the skull, the whole skeleton. It's like you see a skeleton on an exhibition. It's right here inside of you. You can almost feel it. And when you do that, first of all, you then get a slight disenchantment with the body. You don't take the body so seriously anymore. But then you can carry on, and you can actually use the skeleton as a point of focus. And you can contemplate the skeleton by seeing the whiteness, for example, in a skeleton. And the skeleton can turn into a samadhi object. So you start by using it, first of all, to eliminate the desire for the body. And then gradually it turns into a samadhi object, and the skeleton can become brilliant and beautiful, and then become part of your meditation practice. Some people do use it like that, and that's possible to do it like that. And the four elements, you may be able to use them as well in a similar way. But I think the main purpose is just to reflect, yeah? To use your thinking mind, your creativity, to remember that this body is the same as the external elements. And to stay with that. And when you stay with that again and again and again, it sinks in gradually deeper and deeper and deeper. But you have to sustain the awareness. Only with sustained awareness does it start to have an impact on your mind. Yeah, the impact comes gradually, slowly, slowly, slowly. I don't know if you've noticed that before, but sometimes when you contemplate something, it takes a while before it sinks in. And then eventually, bang, things start to happen. And you have an emotional reaction. And that emotional reaction is a reaction whereby the attachment to the body disappears. You can feel that. It's very interesting. Your mind becomes cool, soothed. The attachment and the craving is gone. Okay. Okay, I am confused about metta meditation. Is there a point in wishing beings well if it is not followed by action? Thank you. There is a point, because the point is that you are trying to purify yourself. Yeah. So there is still a point, because you're trying to gain some kind of spiritual improvement in your own life. So if you can use the metta meditation to purify your heart, that is already a wonderful thing. But you are quite right. Not to follow through by action would also be wrong. Remember that before you even get to metta meditation, we should have metta through the way we speak and the way we act in the world. You cannot go around the world and treat people badly and then think you're going to have success in metta meditation. It's never going to work. So you should always start with the basic things. And the basic things are to act and speak with kindness to all the people around you. That is practical metta, metta in action. Start with that. And as you do that, you will actually empower you and enable you then to have metta in your meditation afterwards. So start with the easy things, yeah? Metta meditation can be quite hard. Not everyone is able to feel the metta as you do the metta meditation. A lot of people are not. Don't feel bad if you can't feel anything. It's quite common. But then go back to the more basic things. Act with metta in your daily life. And as you do that, something will happen in your mind. Your mind will slowly turn around, and you will start to have more understanding for the people around you and have more metta. And eventually it will also work in your meditation practice. Start to think about people in a different way. Yeah, this is kind of an important part of this. And as you think of people in a different way, eventually it will transform into metta as well. Okay. Dear respected Ajahn, thank you very much for the beautiful teaching. Why this course is so expensive, and how the one who suffers person can have meditation experience with you? Who has no money to join this course? Okay. Yes, I don't know anything about the price of this course. I am completely, you know, I have no idea. I just come. They say to me, please come to Hong Kong, and I come. But I'm sure there is, you know, they have probably thought out what they are doing. I know the people who run this retreat, and they are very good people. I'm sure they're trying to do the right thing. So sometimes this is just how things pan out. Yeah, don't. I think, yeah, but you can. So, things are expensive in Hong Kong, says Della. Okay, that's the reason. Okay. Okay, donation is so beautiful, but paying meditation course, is it economic? Is it economic? What? Is it economic? I can't really understand your handwriting here. Is it economic responsible? Is that what you mean? Thank you very much. It all depends. Yeah, the problem is that ideally everything would be for free, and you know, really, I teach for free. I don't charge anything personally. And this is kind of my gift to be able to do this. And I don't really expect anything in return, to be honest. And any donation that is given here, it doesn't go to me. It goes to some other cause. Last year, whatever donations came were given to things that didn't even have anything to do with Bodhinyana Monastery. One went to a monastery in the UK where they're trying to establish a Bhikkhuni monastery. Another part went to Sutta Central where they're trying to make the suttas available for the whole world. So I don't do this personally for any personal benefit, yeah? And I think that is the right way of teaching. So usually the reason why you have to pay for this is simply because that's how the modern world works, yeah? It's hard to get hold of the Kaduri Center. It's a beautiful place, but it costs money. Yeah, that's kind of the unfortunate reality with these things. So I must admit, I really appreciate the BIF, the Buddhist International Foundation, or the Bodhinyana International Foundation, and what they're trying to do. I think they're trying to do their best. But if you have some ideas about what can be done, maybe you can speak to some of the committee members afterwards. Maybe something can be organized. Maybe we can have a place or two for people who can't afford. So maybe that's possible in the future if someone is really poor or something. I don't know if that's possible. I don't know. It's not up to me to make any demands. I'm just making a suggestion here. So have a chat with Della afterwards. She is kind of the main. Are you the boss, Della? Is that right? No, it's not the boss. Okay. Talk to Della anyway. Have a chat with Della anyway. Yeah, please.
All of us do not get paid. We are volunteers as well.
Yeah.
And the main course actually is to prove all of this.
Okay.
And the rest of them are just appreciation. Everyone will do it because your participation and the fees that you paid for this particular retreat, some of which will go directly to some Buddhist courses like what Ajahn Brahmati said, like the Sutta Central or the building of the Nuns' Monastery in the UK. This year it's up to Ajahn Brahmati to decide where the donation will go to. So you're actually practicing generosity here. And we do not get any funding from any big foundations anyway. So look at me, I'm a very poor man. And if you have any complaints, please go to Dara.
Go to Dara, okay.
We run very low expenses, we don't even have our own office, and all the committee members who we join the retreat, we pay our own fee as well. So what we pay don't cover any of our expenses at all. And even for other amounts to pay, it's from our own donation, it's not from part of the share of the retreat. So we want to emphasize that. So if you think that's too expensive, we'll try to figure out somewhere more affordable. But Kadori Basin is the cheapest place you can go. So I hope you understand.
It's great, it's cheap, and so wonderful at the same time, yeah? The cheapest and the best, yeah? Whoa.
Very expensive fee. When you pay for food, accommodation, everything is expensive. And I'm sorry about it.
I have full confidence in them, and they're all the best people. I know them quite well now, and they are very, in my opinion, they're very, very good people. I think they're trying their very best.
And
please appreciate.
I also ask if anyone of you is interested in knowing our finances, please go to the I think the company registry. Because we are a non-profit organization, so every year we have to submit our financials to them. You can tell, you can read our financial statements. It's absolutely very clear. I dare to say that we are probably one of the top three cleanest, purest non-profit organizations in Hong Kong. So once again, we're very grateful and very fortunate to have each and every one of you here, you know, to attend our retreat. You have done very well. You have been very generous in not supporting us, but supporting Buddhism. So,
thank you for clarifying. It was actually that's really nice, and we know how
things work. And if I may add, it's happened to some of the fruits that some kind-hearted people, you know, offered to Ajahn Brahmani. I actually pay for his breakfast every morning in my own pocket. So, you know, we really. So I can honestly 100% tell each and every one of you that all of your fees are in good use. Okay, so Hong Kong is a very expensive place. In fact, according to the World Economic Forum, Hong Kong is the most unaffordable city in the whole world. Okay, so I suggest, you know, if some of you are interested in continue to join Ajahn Brahmani's retreats, I'm sure all of you are interested. There are other places you can go as well. You know, Singapore, Malaysia. Even Australia, but of course we like to see each and every one of you again every year. So but you have the choice to select other cities and other venues to attend. So but as I said, we're very happy to see each and every one of you here. As I said, you're very kind-hearted people, as Ajahn Brahmani has repeatedly said, and every single penny that you have spent and donated, you know, in this particular year.
Every single cent. I'm
in good use.
Okay.
So I hope I have clarified your notes. If not, please go talk to
them. I feel a bit sorry for you now, Daryl. I'm going to support you now. How can I support you now? I feel it.
Based on my very limited knowledge of Buddhism, the Buddha, I think he did once said, the gift of the Dhamma excels all gifts. So thank you very much. You have given us the best gift that could have ever given to each and every one of us.
Okay. Very good. So I hope now that is a really comprehensive answer to that question. Wow. Incredibly comprehensive. So I hope you are okay with that. Yeah. And if not, then I have no idea what to say more. So I'm just leave it to one side.
So do check out the financials, either from the company registry or the tax bureau.
Okay, let's move on, shall we? Yeah, let's move on to the next one. Okay, two more questions to go on for tonight. Dear Ajahn, my brother told me that he doesn't mind to be reborn as a cockroach. Can you teach me how to help him start learning the Dhamma? Thanks a million. I think maybe he's probably just joking. He's probably kind of just having some kind of silly argument with you or something. I think if he has any understanding of the life of a cockroach, he wouldn't like that. People running after you, trying to kill you all the time is not a very nice way of living. So how can you help him to start learning the Dhamma? Well, you have to be careful, first of all, to try to get other people to learn the Dhamma. You have to be very gentle, because most people will resist if they feel that they're being pushed around. They tend to be resisting, yeah? So you have to be very, very gentle with how you do that. And the best way to get someone to listen to the Dhamma is to listen to something that is easily accessible, yeah? Something like Ajahn Brahm, when he gives kind of his easy talks. Don't bring Ajahn Brahm straight to meditation retreat with Ajahn Brahm. Do one of his easy talks that are meant for a general audience. And usually it's very easy to listen to. You have a few jokes, you have some nice stories, yeah? You know what Ajahn Brahm is like when he's in a good mood and he kind of just expands on this and that. It's wonderful. There is always some degree of Dhamma in there, but it's light, it's easy, it is general psychology. Ajahn Brahm doesn't tell you, believe in rebirth or get lost. He doesn't say anything like that. He is always easy. It's a general truth that are just as true in any religion as they are in Buddhism. And this is kind of the beauty of these teachings. So bring your brother to something like that. Yeah? Say, come along, listen to this psychologist. Yeah, you can present Ajahn Brahm as a psychologist. That makes it more, perhaps more palatable if he's not really into Buddhism. And then gradually he will kind of, I think he must be having you on. Nobody means that seriously. You want to be reborn as a cockroach? He must be just giving you a hard time or something. Because that's kind of being a bit silly, isn't it? So he probably means that he doesn't believe in rebirth. That's probably what it means. So just gradually introduce him in this way. And one of the important ways of getting someone interested in the Dhamma is not for you to teach them the Dhamma, but to find some kind of authority that he believes in. Yeah, you have to find some authority that he actually trusts, that he will listen to. Chances are he won't listen to you because you are a family member. Yeah, it's very difficult to get your family members to come around. But get some external authority that he might listen to. A mutual friend, a mutually family member, somewhere that he actually finds inspiring and interesting. And then introduce him gradually. Then there is a sneaky way. This is Ajahn Brahm. I get everything I say from Ajahn Brahm, right? So everything comes from Ajahn Brahm. So he says that what you should do to get someone interested in the Dhamma, you should take a Dhamma book, an easy, nice Dhamma book, a Dhamma book that you think he will like. You should bring it back home, maybe go to your brother's place, put it on the table, and then you should tell your brother, this Dhamma book, you are not allowed to read it. Yeah, this is my Dhamma book, I know you're not interested, must not read this Dhamma book. And then when you leave his apartment or whatever, you kind of forget it behind, yeah? And then you call up later and say, please, don't read that Dhamma book which I left on the table. And then he will be so curious, what on earth is this book about? Yeah, don't even say Dhamma book, say don't read that book. And then he will be so curious, because he thinks it's some kind of secret doctrine or something. And then he will open it up and he will start reading. And then, bang, before you know it, he's hooked. And then he is converted to the path, and then you are in business. So sometimes you have to be sneaky, you have to be tricky here. And sometimes you read the suttas, you see Venerable Ananda, he also does little sneaky, tricky things to get people to hear the Dhamma. So it's a long kind of line there of people being sneaky about how to get people to hear the Dhamma. So we are in good company here. It's good, it's a good cause. You're coming from compassion, so you're doing a good thing here. So just be wise about it, and you will always find a way of getting your brother to come around to something positive.
And if I may add, please don't donate to Ajahn Brahmani, and don't donate to us. Please, just don't donate to us. No donations.
No donations, sir. Okay, yeah.
I'm trying to be tricky.
Okay, no, we do not want donations, I see. Okay, all right, okay. Yeah, we'll see what happens. Okay. Last question for tonight. Dear Ajahn, can you share with us the spark when you decided to become a monk? What was that moment like? Where did the determination come from? Thank you in advance. It is not as exciting as you think it is, yeah. These things always sound exciting in theory, but the reality is far more mundane. And when I look back on my life and I look at how these things come about, People, you know, you always like to kind of flatter yourself to think, yeah, I'm smart, I'm chosen the best path, and all this kind of thing. That's what most people like to think about themselves. But I think the reality, the real reason I'm a Buddhist monk, I think, is because I was a Buddhist monk in a past life. That's what I think. So when I got born into this life, I was already on the track to become a monk. Yeah, because it's the habit. It's not habit from the past. You go like a robot, duk, 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 give me the robe, duk, shave your head, and then you become a monk. Sit down, give a talk, and you give a talk. That's kind of that's what happens. It's like being a robot. So whether you have a robot monk who does like in Japan, they have the robot monks who do the chanting. I'm also like a robot monk. And so this is just, I think it is, why do I say that? Because when I look back on my life, it has come fairly naturally, yeah, come fairly easily. You wouldn't think so. I was born in this really cold country called Norway. There's all ice and snow 6 months of the year. Didn't have any Buddhist friends. My family wasn't Buddhist. Where does it come from? Why was I ever interested in the Buddhist teachings? And I remember when I was quite young, I think I was about 12 years old, I had this fantasy of living in the forest, in the kuti, by myself. Why do you, as a 12-year-old, have this idea that you want to live in the kuti, in the forest, by yourself? I don't know. The only way I can explain that, it must come from the past life somewhere. Where else does it come from? When I traveled to Asia for the first time, I was about 21 years old, and I was studying engineering at the time, and I went to Japan. We had a kind of exchange program, so I stayed in Japan. I read my first book on Buddhism. I thought, whoa, this is really good stuff. I went to my first temples, I saw all the Buddha statues, and I really enjoyed that. Where does it come from? Then when I came back to my university, one of my very best friends, he gave me a book. He said, read this book. Okay, it was a book on mindfulness of breathing. It just came to me, mindfulness of breathing. Okay, so I read it, and I started to try the technique. I got some good results, and that was really the critical thing that kind of made me decide, much later, the critical thing that kind of made it clear to me that this is something very powerful and beautiful going on with these teachings. Just that little experience, a little bit of peace in your meditation, coming through a book that you read, was really the critical thing that made this path possible. And then I went to a monastery at some stage, and then I heard about Ajahn Brahm, and when I heard about Ajahn Brahm, I knew, this is my teacher. So I flew all the way from England, I was living in England at the time, flew from England to Australia, and I've been there ever since. That's my monastic life, yeah? So why did I become a monk? I wish I could say, yeah, I'm really smart, I know where the best teachings are. I'm not, I'm stupid, just like everyone else. Yeah, it's just already ingrained in me, the idea of becoming a monk. Look, just walk forward, and you end up in brown robes, just like that. That is, I think, the reality. So what do you think? Pretty disappointing, isn't it? That's what happens. But, so don't worry too much about where it comes from. For me now, the real thing now that sustains me in my monastic life is the conviction that this actually is the very purpose of existence. The Buddhist teaching is the answer to the meaning of life. If you get that just a little bit, yeah, but this is the answer to the meaning of life, you also are going to end up one day as a monastic, as a nun or a monk. Why? Because really, there's nothing else to do. This is the very purpose of existence. This is what you should be doing. And then all the good things come to you as a consequence. Yeah, all the things that the Buddha taught, all the happiness in the world, all the meaning that you can possibly ever ask for, come as a consequence of that. What a wonderful thing that is, that there is even such a thing as an answer to such a profound question as the meaning of life. Anyway, the questions are empty, and it's exactly 9 o'clock. Whee, perfect timing. So let's just do the Arahant Sammasambuddha together, and then call it a night afterwards.